This is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Dan Friedel, and Katie Weaver. Later, Phil Dierking and Dorothy Gundy will present the next part in our series on America's national parks. But first, here is John Russell.
As polar bears fight for survival because of disappearing Arctic sea ice, a new group of Greenland bears seems to have found an icy area that might permit a small population to hang on. But the situation overall for the endangered polar bear species remains serious. Scientists say the animals are in danger of disappearing because of the effects of climate change. A team of scientists recently studied a group of a few hundred polar bears in southeast Greenland. These bears are genetically different and geographically separate from others. What is unusual about these bears is that they survive even while having just 100 days a year when there is enough sea ice to hunt seals. In other places, polar bears need at least 180 days, usually more, of sea ice for them to effectively hunt. When there is no sea ice, bears often do not eat for months. Sea ice is frozen ocean water. With limited amounts of this ice, the southeast Greenland polar bears use freshwater ice masses called icebergs. The icebergs, created from the shrinking Greenland ice sheet, serve as hunting grounds, scientists say. A study on the new finding recently appeared in the publication Science. The scientists, however, are not sure if the bears might be surviving because they are smaller and have fewer babies than other polar bear populations. Kristen Leiter was the lead writer of the study. Over 9 years, Leiter followed, studied, and tested the all-white bears, usually from a helicopter. These polar bears are adapted to living in an environment that looks like the future, Leiter said. But Leiter added that Greenland is special. Most bears in the Arctic don't have glacial ice, she said. Leiter explained, "We project large declines of polar bears across the Arctic, and this study does not change that very important message." The population of polar bears is on the southeast part of Greenland, where there are no towns. For years, scientists believed these bears were part of the same population that existed in northeast Greenland. But they are not, Leiter said. Wind and other conditions around 64 degrees north make it next to impossible for bears to move north of that point, she added. While most bears travel 40 kilometers over 4 days, the southeast Greenland bears go about 10 kilometers in the same amount of time, the study found. They just stay in the same place for years and years, Leiter said. Beth Shapiro was the co-writer of the study. She said genetic testing has shown that the southeast Greenland bears are different from other polar bear populations. In general, the southeast Greenland bears are thinner than other Arctic bears, with females weighing about 185 kilograms. This compares to weights of about 199 to 255 kilograms for bears in other parts of the North American Arctic, Leiter said. The Southeast Greenland bears also have fewer babies, she added. This could be because they are so isolated and do not get as many chances to reproduce. They're not reproducing as much as other individuals. They're not as healthy as other individuals who are in a better habitat, Shapiro said. She used the term oasis, meaning a safe place that is surrounded by something unpleasant, to describe where the bears live. So it's kind of an oasis, maybe, but it's not a happy oasis, Shapiro said. It's a I'm struggling to get by but just making it kind of oasis. I'm John Russell.
Exterior is a clothing company in Italy owned by Nadia Zanola. She started the company in 1997 based on a small business her parents started in 1952. Zanola has 50 workers in the northern city of Brescia. She is worried about the future of her company. She made a lot of clothing for people in Russia, but because of international economic restrictions, the stores that asked for the clothes cannot pay her. The restrictions, known as sanctions, started earlier this year because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. They are meant to punish Russia for the war by making it hard to send money to other countries or to receive goods. The sanctions, however, are also making business difficult for people like Zanola, who depend on sales in Russia. She has over $2 million worth of clothing she made for Russian stores, for which she has not been paid. If they cannot pay for it, I will be on my knees, Zanola said. She called the situation painful. The sanctions are hurting a number of businesses in Italy that make costly goods made from cloth and leather, such as clothing and shoes. Italy is the largest producer of these kinds of high-cost products in the world. The industry adds $101 billion to Italy's economy each year. While Russian customers only add about 3% of that total, any loss hurts the 80,000 small businesses supplying that market. Fabio Petrella is the president of a fashion industry trade group in Italy. He said, losing Russian customers takes away over 80% of the money the small businesses make each year. Areas in Italy such as Marche, Veneto, Umbria, and Emilia-Romagna depend on orders from Russia. These are districts that connect the supply chain, Petrella said. He noted that if small producers close, it will hurt the entire system that makes this country an economic powerhouse. Some of the world's most famous fashion companies like Gucci, Versace, and Armani are Italian. They are showing off their clothing for men this week in Milan. A number of Italian companies such as Diesel, Benetton, and Armani are still doing business in Russia. Their names appear on a list put together by Yale University business professor Jeffrey Sonnenberg. He called those companies greedy. He noted that companies that continued selling goods to Nazi Germany after the start of World War II are not celebrated. Sonnenberg said, clothing companies are not able to find ways to get past the sanctions the way the drug or agriculture industries do. Other clothing companies in France and Spain broke ties with Russia when the war started. LVMH is a French business that includes fashion brands Louis Vuitton, Christian Dior, Givenchy, and Fendi. LVMH is still paying its 3,500 Russian employees, even though it is no longer doing business there. Pietrella said, he and the businesses he works for have extreme concern over the aggression in Ukraine. He said, there is no way to defend Russia's actions. But he added, we have to think of our companies. Ethics are one thing, the market is another. Workers in a company are paid by the market, not by ethics. For those who say the companies should find a new market for their products, he said, that is easier said than done. If there was another market, we would be there already, Pietrella said. For companies like Zanola's De Exterior, it took many years to build business in Russia. It now makes up 35 to 40% of the $22 million her company brings in each year. The Exterior is also under extra financial pressure because of rising energy and materials costs. When Russia invaded Ukraine in late February, the company was already sending clothes that were ordered for the summer and taking orders for the winter. But by March, Zanola's customers in Russia were missing payments. She said, it is not likely she will get money for the 4,000 pieces of spring and summer clothes she is holding. And a contract said she had to go ahead and start making some of the winter clothes. If she cannot send the winter items to Russia, she will lose at least $100,000. She said, Russian customers are good because they appreciate the extra work it takes to make nice clothes. After working so hard to gain the customers, she does not want to give them up. She said she hopes people recognize the difference between Russian leader Vladimir Putin and the Russian people. Since Russia is not only Putin, one hopes the poor Russians manage to raise themselves up, she said. I'm Dan Friedel.
Summer is a time for gardeners to enjoy the beauty of flowers and the harvesting of fruits and vegetables they have grown. But gardeners also recognize the risks that severe summer storms can bring. In the United States, weather officials are predicting another busy storm season in some areas. This could mean heavy rain, tropical storms, and hurricanes. Associated Press gardening expert Jessica Damiano has some useful suggestions for protecting gardens, along with homes and other structures, before and after serious storms. When storms are predicted, take down patio covers and bring outdoor furniture, like chairs and tables, indoors. Examine trees for broken branches and remove them. This way, they will not be sent flying in strong winds. If the trees are large, hire a tree expert to examine them. The cost of this service is nothing compared to the damage trees might cause if stormy weather uproots them and they fall. In warmer climates, palm trees stand up well to high wind conditions, so there is no need to cut them. It is suggested, however, that any coconut fruits are removed from the tree and stored safely indoors. If your soil is mostly wet, either naturally or from recent rain, put down about 8 centimeters of mulch over plant areas and borders. This will offer protection against water flows and possible flooding. Some trees are more likely to come out of the ground in these conditions because their roots do not go very deep. These include white pine, birch, willow, and tulip poplar. Put a stake down next to any newly planted trees to support them. Bring hanging flowers and other contained plants into the house or another sheltered area. If this is not possible, line them up against the house or next to a wall. Protect any flowers on small plants by placing buckets or other protective coverings over them. Wrap larger plants with cloth material secured with string. Orchids, bromeliads, succulents, air plants, and other tree-dwelling plants can be tied into place with fishing line. Place special garden cloth over young growing seedlings and secure it to the ground with stakes. Once the storm has passed, quickly clear away all fallen fruit and vegetables. If left on the ground, the food can rot. It can also attract unwanted animals. Remove any protective coverings you had put in place. Examine all trees for damage. If you can safely remove hanging, broken branches from the ground, do so. But avoid removing anything higher than your head or climbing a ladder. Such work is better left to professionals. The International Society of Arborists keeps a list of registered tree professionals on its website. If a small tree has come down, whether by break or uproot, straighten and stake it as soon as possible. You may even have to replant. Put down mulch or straw over the soil, keeping it 10 centimeters away from the center of the tree. Water the tree normally for the rest of the growing season. This will help reestablish the root system. Wind helps trees strongly develop, so only keep the stakes in place for 6 months to a year. Storms near oceans can spread a lot of salt on coastal lands. High levels of salt can dry out and damage trees and bushes. Putting mulch around trees can help keep them wet. Watering deeply can also remove any salt from the soil around plants and trees. Most plants will not survive if large amounts of salt collect on top of the soil and form a hard surface. The soil, however, can be saved. To treat salt-damaged areas, water deeply, then spread gypsum over the soil. This substance reacts with the salt to form sodium sulfate, which will wash through the ground with repeated waterings. In these cases, you should continue watering deeply for the rest of the year. I'm Katie Weaver.
In our national parks journey, we explore a vast area with mountains, beaches, forests, and glaciers. The area's huge range in both rainfall and elevation make it one of the most diverse parks in America. Welcome to Olympic National Park. The park is located in the western state of Washington. It is on the Olympic Peninsula in the northwest part of the state. The park covers more than 400,000 hectares. It has several different ecosystems. Visitors will find temperate rainforests, glacier-covered mountains, and almost 120 kilometers of wild coastline.
The Olympic Peninsula has seen travelers from many countries throughout history, including Mexico, Spain, France, Russia, and England. Many travelers from these countries arrived in the late 1700s. They were searching for the Northwest Passage. The sea route connects the Northern Atlantic and Pacific Oceans by way of the Arctic Ocean. These explorers all claimed to discover different parts of what is now Olympic National Park. In 1792, English captain George Vancouver explored the peninsula in great detail by boat. He named many of the natural features in the area. Later, people began moving west across North America to search for gold. This era was known as the Gold Rush. Many people came to the western United States in search of gold. At the time, the Olympic Peninsula was not very developed and did not have roads. People had to travel by boat or horse to explore the peninsula.
Early settlers reached the Olympic Peninsula in the mid-1800s. At first, people built homes on the coast. This area was easier to access and had good land for farming. Life on the Olympic Peninsula was difficult, however. People lived far from large cities and resources. They cut trees to build cabins. They also hunted and fished for food. Later, people started making expeditions into the center of the peninsula. They explored its forests and mountains. These areas never became very populated, however. To protect the nature of the area, President Grover Cleveland declared the Olympic Peninsula's forests as the Olympic Forest Reserve in 1897. And in 1938, President Franklin Roosevelt signed the bill that established the Olympic National Park.
Eight Native American tribes are closely connected to the area. One tribe, the Makah, has a long history of whaling. The U.S. bans whaling, but the Makah tribe is permitted to continue practicing this tradition in small amounts. American courts also gave Native American tribes the right to continue their traditional fishing practices in the area. Protecting fish resources is important to the Native Americans living on the Olympic Peninsula. They work with the National Park Service to protect the area's natural resources.
Olympic National Park has meadows and lakes. It has glacier-fed rivers and mountain peaks that rise more than 2,300 meters. Each area of the park offers visitors something special. The Elwha Valley is in the central part of the park. It is the Olympic Peninsula's largest watershed. A watershed is an area of land that separates waters that flow to different rivers or seas. Long ago, the rivers in this area held the most salmon outside of Alaska. The area also was home to bears, eagles, cougars, and the Tlalum Native Americans. In the 1920s, a growing community of settlers built two hydroelectric dams to provide energy for the local economy. The dams created many problems for the river. They decreased the water in the rivers, which caused the fish population in the area to decrease. This affected the other animals that depended on fish for food. The community later decided to fix these problems. In 1992, Congress passed the Elwha River Ecosystem and Fisheries Restoration Act. Both dams have been removed, and the National Park Service is using fish hatcheries to increase the salmon population. Today, the Elwha River is the site of one of the largest ecosystem restoration projects in National Park Service history.
The Ho River is on the west side of the park. The river is formed from melted glacial ice on top of Mount Olympus. The river is 80 kilometers long. It empties into the Pacific Ocean. The area receives about 400 centimeters of rain each year. It is a temperate rainforest. Because of the amount of rain, many different types of plants grow in the Ho rainforest, from mosses and ferns to huge Sitka spruce trees. The Ho River Valley is protected from any logging or development. Hurricane Ridge is a mountain area in the northern part of the park. It is easy to enter and provides incredible views of the Olympic Mountains. The ridge has many hiking paths. In winter, people come here to ski. They also come here to take part in other fun winter activities like sledding and snowboarding. Hurricane Ridge usually has snow from December through the end of March. Visitors must be prepared for icy roads and severe weather.
The westernmost part of the park is Pacific coastline. Olympic National Park has many breathtaking beaches. Rialto Beach is known for its tall sea stacks. These formations are tall towers of rock standing in the sea. North of Rialto Beach is Hole in the Wall. It is a natural arch that has been carved by the powerful sea. Claylike Beach is known for its white sand. It also has three national wildlife refuges, which protect the area's bird and fish species. The coastline areas offer hiking and camping. They are some of the most popular places in the park.
Olympic National Park offers difficult mountain hikes. It offers relaxing beaches and exciting walks through lush rainforests. There is truly something for everyone at Olympic National Park. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Phil Dierking.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.